Total portfolio performance for the period ending June 30th.
June 30th.
2015.
It should be September 30th.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I think it's shown on the agenda.
We need to correct the agenda. September 30th. Mr. Whalen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Before we get started, I just want to formally thank Deborah Allen for asking me to dance on the deck of the aircraft carrier.
This man can break dance.
Let you all know that I'm submitting her name for the next season of Dancing with the Stars. So.
We also noticed that you submitted your dry cleaning bill for at least one half of your jacket.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Quite a party I missed.
I turned around. I thought he'd fallen down. I looked at, but there were no first responders headed in his direction, so it was all part of the act.
That's kind of great.
So, that said, I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on the economic environment. I'm going to talk about briefly the domestic economic environment, and then move to international. Talk a little bit about the landscape for credit. And then I'll show the table of recent historical returns, and you'll see a lot of red on that table. And then we'll move into performance. I'll spend a little bit of time on the overall plan and then talk about managers. Does that sound reasonable? Okay. If you take a look at behind tab one of your performance report at page 5, it's a summary page for the U.S. economy. And what you see here is sort of reasonable economic statistics. You see the table on the right, top line starting with gross domestic product. The most recent print was 2.7. The third quarter, I understand, was just revised upward from 1.5 to 2.1, I think, so kind of continuing along that slow and steady growth trend. Inflation has been low, and of course this is the concern of the Fed, and one of the things that they're trying to fix is raise that inflation number, and it's just about at zero. And then you see expected inflation moving out into the future, as predicted by the futures markets, has been coming down. The Fed funds rate remains at about zero, certainly not a normal environment, and one that the futures markets are predicting is going to change in December. So they've been predicting this for quite some time now. In fact, I've been taking the informal poll with my clients. I'm curious, for those of you that pay attention to stuff like this and have an opinion, how many of you think that the Fed is going to raise in December, just by a show of hands?
We had a Sackers observation by one of our speakers, absolutely, that it would. I think that was Grunlock, if I'm recalling correctly.
Said they were going to.
Yeah.
Okay. And, people have been predicting this rate rise for quite some time. They predicted it at the last Fed meeting. It didn't happen. They're now predicting it at this one. And I think the futures markets are betting now with about a 70% chance that they're going to raise in December. We'll see what happens. You know, the interesting part about this is, depending on what the Fed does, the risk markets could go either way, right, with the following reasoning. If the Fed raises, risk markets could say, okay, the Fed is kind of giving an all clear, and now they're going to start on this path to normalization, which means that the economy and maybe even the global economy is somewhat healthy, and so all is well. And we're off to the races. If they raise, the flip side of that is that all those future cash flows that you are anticipating as an investor are going to now be discounted at a higher rate, which lowers their present value. So, you know, they could be concerned about that. And that sort of has what's been happening in the past with predictions of Fed raising is risk markets have pulled back. And I think today is a potential indication of that happening, because you had the economy, the GDP was adjusted upwards for the third quarter, and markets sold off. Not saying that there's a cause and effect there, but a potential cause and effect could be, okay, now we're really concerned that the Fed may raise and may raise faster, which would be discounting those future cash flows to a lower present value. So, and then, of course, the flip side of that is, Fed doesn't raise, And everybody's concerned now because the Fed is saying, oh my gosh, they're worried. Or Fed doesn't raise, and they say, well, now we're going to discount the future cash flows at a lower rate pretty much forever. So either way they go, it could have either way on the markets. And I have no idea which way it's going to go. So.
With the presidential election a year from now, do you think it's better, they may think it's better to do it now so people won't think about it at the election, or better to hold off?
You know, putting politics in the mix is always a big and unknown variable, and I don't know to the extent that the Fed actually thinks about politics. They're not supposed to. They say they don't. Perhaps it's inevitable that they do, but it's kind of one of those known unknowables. Moving down the page to the 10-year rate. So this is the 10-year Treasury rate of interest, and you can see that that is down from 12 months prior. It's ratcheted up a little bit since September 30. I think it's at about 2.2 now, kind of in anticipation of the Fed raising. Moving to unemployment, the U3 is the headline number, coming down. The interesting thing about the unemployment number, right, we're getting into a range where you've got a pretty good headline unemployment number. But there's still quite a bit of slack in the labor force because the participation rate has also dropped. So that 5.1% isn't as good as it appears. There's still a fair amount of slack in the labor force. Let's just take a look at slide 6 really quickly. The chart on the lower left-hand portion of the page I think is interesting because if you look at the components of those quarterly GDP numbers, you can see where it's coming from. So you've had good and fairly strong consumption, which if you read the financial press, you know that that has been the area of growth lately, and automobiles in particular. You look at where there's been a drag, and you see that it's from imports, and that's largely due to the strengthening dollar, largely due to the strengthening economy, and the fact that we're in a tightening mode rather than a loosening mode where the rest of the world is. So our dollar, as you know, has been strengthening, and that's having a drag on GDP from an imports perspective and exports as well to some degree. And then you can see that labor force participation rate in the chart on the lower right-hand portion of the page on page 7. And so you see how it has historically, or in recent history, trended up consistently and has since trended down pretty significantly from the global financial crisis. There's a demographic element of that, right, with the aging workforce, but also just folks underemployed and frustrated workers leaving the workforce. Next, let's flip over to international, and happy to take any questions along the way, just in case you have an interest in any of this stuff. To page 12, and so you can see here the primary economic statistics, GDP, inflation, and unemployment for the U.S., the ones we just touched on, and then you can compare those to the Eurozone, Japan, and then the primary BRIC nations, or what were historically the primary emerging markets nations. And you can see Western Europe, still slow and steady growth, most of which is coming from Germany. Inflation issues similar to ours, and unemployment rate worse than ours. So their unemployment situation is, I'm sure you know, particularly in the periphery nations, is pretty bad, in some cases upwards of 25%. Japan is an interesting story because they have really been throwing everything that they have at their deflation and growth problems. They are providing tremendous monetary stimulus. I mean, they look like, they make our quantitative easing look like a walk in the park. They are providing fiscal stimulus. They're also trying to re-engineer corporate governance to sort of unshackle the workforce. You look at their unemployment rate at 3.3%, right? It's hard to lose a job in Japan. And so they're looking to make big changes in terms of governance and just behavioral changes that will make their economy more productive. And our view from looking at what they're trying to do is that it seems to be working sort of slowly. Shifts like that are never easy and take time and are politically risky. It seems to be working. However, they just entered into their second technical recession since Abe took charge, and so it's definitely going to be in fits and starts, but we're somewhat positive on Japan. And then you look at the primary emerging market nations, and you can see the slower growth there relative to what we've been used to over the past decade, and some of those nations are really struggling. China is the big dog in that group, and as you may know, that 7% is a very questionable number. It's the economic statistics coming out of Japan are interesting and not perfectly reliable. The market believes, or the talking heads believe, that it is something below that and potentially something well below that.
Is that also true of India? Are their numbers any more reliable than China's?
There hasn't been a lot of attention paid, at least in the press, on the reliability of Indians' economic statistics. The view is that it's a more open economy, not so much command and control, and so the statistics are a little bit more reliable there. Okay, so let's turn to credit. Actually, let's take a look at page 16, just to give you a sense of that things are still not by any means normal in a historical sense. You can look at short-term rates across the board there, or in many cases there, and see that you still have negative nominal short-term rates, which means that you're paying people to lend them money, right? And a very uncommon situation, and not one that you would link to a good, strong, healthy economy.
Any observations on why Greece is only at 5% and Brazil at 14?
So Brazil has got some real big problems. You know that they're linked to the commodities economy, right? They have inflation. Their balance of payments has ballooned. They're really in sort of a mess and in kind of a downward spiral. So, and by the way, they don't have the backing of the European Union. So Brazil is struggling. Greece is struggling as well, but with that sort of, I won't say implicit guarantee, but so far the backing of Germany and the European Central Bank, Greece has been able to kind of come through their problems.
The Olympics will fix it.
Okay, so let's flip over to slide 20. And so you all do have some dedicated credit exposure in your portfolio, and the credit markets have been challenging of late, and it's really been driven by, so spreads have widened, but it's really been driven by energy prices. And as energy prices have come down, a large part of the investments that were made in the fracking fields were funded by issuance in the high yield market. So you've got high-yield bonds going to investments that were pulling energy, pulling oil out of the ground, oil and natural gas out of the ground. As prices fell, it's not perfectly clear that those debts will be paid back, which has caused spreads to widen, which has had a ripple effect across certainly the high yield. You can see in the table on the lower right-hand portion of the page here, U.S. high yield at 6.84, U.S. high yield energy at 11.38. So that's really the tail that's wagging that dog, and it's bled into credit markets, even investment grade credit markets as well. And you can see that the spreads have increased a little bit there from a year ago at 1.52 up 70 basis points to 2.12. So credit in general has moved out. It's come back in since 9:30, but still out from historical standards, largely driven by energy markets. Let's take a look back at the last page of this tab and look at the index returns table. So this table is split into domestic equity, international equity, fixed income, and other, and you can see sort of across the board, we've had a risk-off environment through the last quarter, which has gone back to year-to-date and in many cases to the one-year period. So let's just take a look at some of these as examples. You can see the S&P 500 quarter-to-date down 6.4, which made it essentially flat for the 1 year, ending 9/30. You look at international markets down below, so let's just take a look at the first line there, which represents developed markets at 10.2% negative, going back to 1 year at 8.7. So domestic continues to, international continues to struggle relative to domestic. And you look at emerging markets, two lines down, the MSCI EM index there at 17.9, the 1 year number at 19.3. Emerging markets has really been hit hard by this withdrawal or concern of additional withdrawal of liquidity from the system as the US starts to reduce its monetary stimulus.
How are proponents of indexing going? How are they feeling right now? Proponents are always telling us to go to index or saying that fees are like, when you look at this, what's the reaction?
Yeah. So I think that the, well, it depends on who you talk to, certainly, but I think the hardcore academics will say, will continue to say, indexing makes a lot of sense because it's hard to predict alpha and it's hard to predict who will get you alpha. So alpha is by its very nature sort of unstable and comes in waves, and trying to predict who's going to get it for you in advance is difficult, net of fees in particular. We have a little bit different view. I mean, we subscribe to that viewpoint by and large, but we think that there are pockets where it makes sense to go active, and certainly in this environment, emerging markets, we think active makes sense.
Scott, October was spectacular for the S&P 500. What impact did it have on international?
Gosh, I wish I had brought that off the top of my head. I don't know, but it was strong for international as well, but I'm
as
just
well?
Not sure about the impact of the dollar on those returns. Tim, do you have any sense of that?
I don't have the numbers on.
Yeah. So I think you'll see a bump in October and in November in international markets as well, but I just don't know what and I think the dollar was relatively flat through that period, so you should see good positive returns in international emerging markets.
Thanks.
Okay. So any additional questions on the economic environment before we move on to performance? Let's take a look behind tab 2 at page 2, and you can see the just a summary, the portfolio reconciliation, where you were at the start of the quarter and at the end. You started with $7.1 billion. You ended with about $7 billion. You can see how that came to be with net additions of $191 million and investment earnings negative of $300 million. The good news, to John's point, is through November 20th, you were back up to $7.2 billion. So you did see some recovery in October and November. Sort of not terrific comfort, given that your year-to-date has been pretty flat, and we'll see that momentarily. Okay, so let's take a look at the next page. So I think these charts are good charts for you to just gain some familiarity with. They're just snapshots that give you kind of a background sense of what's going on. You can see the chart on the left-hand portion of the page, the market value history, cumulative cash flows, shows a little bit negative there in the last quarter. Interestingly, or perhaps more interestingly, down at the bottom is the green, the net cash flow, and you can see how that is just slowly widening in a pretty stable pattern of up in the last quarter, and then, or up in the third quarter, and then down, which I guess is the first quarter of your fiscal year, and then down through slowly through the remaining part of the year, ending up typically a little bit below where you came in. So kind of slowly increasing net cash flow. And then you can look at the chart on the right-hand portion of the page and see that you can see the asset allocation history and see that currently you are very closely aligned with your policy targets, which is also shown in more detail on page 4, which takes us to page 5, which is the performance. And as I've been leading up to for the quarter, negative 4.1 performance, so weak absolute performance for sure. You can see the year-to-date number at 0.2% and the one-year number at 2.6. So it's been a slow growth 12 months. And let's see where let's take a look at where the performance came from. So you look at domestic equity, you can see 7.8% negative versus the Russell 3000, your benchmark there. International equity, outperformance relative to your benchmarks at 9.2%, so a positive there from active management. Global equity, another positive at 8.3%. You can see the impact of that international and emerging markets in the international equity relative to domestic there. Your fixed income, 0.4%, so certainly an anchor to windward and performing its diversifying role there, but not a huge tailwind. You can see at 0.4%, underperforming the Barclays Ag by 1.2. And then moving down into high yield, here's where those challenges from widening credit spreads came from, negative 4.9, right on top of the benchmark. And then global fixed income, issues with, you know, there's currency issues in there at negative 0.2. If you look at the allocation chart, the attribution chart on the right-hand portion of that page, you can see where your returns came from relative to your index. And the big bar across the top, you have to kind of take that in perspective and look at the scale. We're talking about everything is all in is less than a percentage point here, right? So while the big bar looks like it's providing big impacts, the impacts are not that great. But the primary impact for the quarter came from allocation effect, and on balance relative to the index, active managers slightly had a negative effect there, the green, and interaction effects, which is kind of the plug figure, additional slight negative. Okay. What I should have done is gone to the next page for the returns in the portfolio before going to the attribution effects, but let's do that now. So the inflation hedge allocation was quite negative relative to the benchmark. This is because the two strategies that you have in that inflation hedge bucket have additional exposures in there other than just inflation, right? And you have an inflation benchmark, CPI plus 4, which is going to be positive and stable. So as those risks associated with those strategies in your inflation hedge bucket overwhelm sort of the inflation risk, you're going to get tracking error to that benchmark. And that's essentially what happened in the quarter. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to the managers. Real estate, relative to your real estate benchmark, underperformed, although I think your real estate managers performed reasonably well for the quarter. And then in your alternatives bucket, you can see 0.1 versus the lagged equity index of 1.3. Let's take a quick look at the one-year attribution, and it looks quite a bit different than the quarterly attribution. So this is the right of the page on page 6, and you can see that over the one-year period, your active managers actually provided a fair amount of tailwind there, and your allocation effect was slightly positive, and your interaction effect slightly negative. Okay. So one page that I like to spend a little bit more time on is page 9, and I think this gives a good sense of the risks in the portfolio. Just a good snapshot, good intuitive sense of the risks in the portfolio. You can see the chart, the risk return chart on the left portion of the page shows where you guys are relative to all the little dots that are 80 of your peers that were able to glean data for this analysis. You can see relative to your policy index, and you can see relative to the median peer. And so you see the total fund there a little bit up and to the right. That means you're taking some additional risk relative to your median peer group, but that risk has been paying off pretty well for you. And so a little bit of risk on there, been getting you some good excess returns. If you were to draw sort of an average line through that, you would see that you guys are above the line, which means that you've improved your Sharpe ratio relative to your peers with the additional risk that you've been taking. And then over to the left, up, down market capture. So this is something that you like to see good upside capture and low downside capture. So you want to be, ideally, you'd be sort of above the median line, the black line that runs across the middle horizontally, and below the median line, the black line that runs up and down vertically. You guys are sort of right in the middle. So you can see your upmarket capture ratio that for 5 years has been 103.98, just above that chart. Your downmarket capture at 100. So you're getting good upside when markets are up, and you're sort of right where the markets are. You're capturing the down market when markets are down. You have an annualized standard deviation of 9.51%. Annualized return of 9.51%, annualized standard deviation of 7.89. That 7.89% is low relative to history, so we would expect over longer periods, and we've been in a sort of a low standard deviation environment, largely due to the fact that we're being supported by all this Fed liquidity. We would expect over the longer term that number would creep up a little bit.
Hey, Scott?
Yeah.
On the risk versus return chart, the sort of the scatter diagram of, I guess, the peer group for which data was available suggests that we are sort of above and in a good place relative to peers. The up markets versus down markets, I don't know, I'm just going just by the graphic, looks like the scatter diagram shows probably a healthy percentage of funds that are either slightly above us or appear to be anyway, based on the scale. I can't tell.
So you're just looking at the dots?
Yeah, I'm just looking at us relative to the dots.
So what you know is that the median lines represent the middle, the middle fund in within those 40 portfolios. And, you know, you can see some are getting additional upside capture, but with that comes additional downside capture. You don't want to really be above that 100 line, that 100 mark. Oh, so I, you know what, I take that back.
Yeah, we do want to be above the 100.
Oh, no, it is the median. Yeah, so no, that's correct. I didn't make a mistake. So downside capture, you want to be below that 100 mark. On upside capture, you want to be above it. And you can see a lot of folks are kind of above them both. So they're getting, most folks are getting higher upside with higher downside. And then when they don't get the higher upside, so they're getting lower upside with lower downside, and you would kind of expect that, right? Because you would expect symmetry there. So it would be great if you could get higher upside and lower downside, and that's the upper left-hand quadrant, and you can see there's very few folks in that one, right?
Yeah, I saw this when I first reviewed this. When I got the packet, I didn't understand it. I still don't think I fully understand this chart. So it's probably the manner in which I'm reading it.
And I apologize for not explaining it
No, it's not.
Can I take a shot at that?
Please. I'll take all the help I can get.
So on the left-hand chart, risk versus return, nirvana for us is sort of where we're at, or, you know, in that upper right quadrant.
Actually, upper left quadrant would be better, but you guys are higher than you are to the right, so yes.
Okay, and in the other side, really being up in that upper left quadrant, or to the left of the vertical line, is or higher than where we are, and to the left of the vertical line is our target.
Yeah, if you could get good upside with low downside, that's winning the game.
No, I'm just following it as she's talking.
Okay.
That probably didn't help.
So let's take a quick look at some of your managers down below, really kind of by exception. Your managers are performing as expected in most cases. You look at the PIMCO Stocks Plus, and you can see some underperformance there. Keeping in mind how they get their returns, they're basically buying the index, so you're getting that index return, and then on top of it, they try and generate excess return in the fixed income markets. And in those fixed income markets, they had some positions on that didn't work out. They were long Brazil. They were they had lower rates. They were expecting lower rates. Shorter duration on the U.S. curve. So not expecting lower rates in the U.S. And then they had some credit in the portfolio as well. We talked a little bit about credit. If you move down to Emerald Advisors,
isn't that they had a great year?
You can see some good outperformance there, and a lot of your managers actually did protect on this in this risk-off environment. So some of your managers provided some good downside protection for you. Emerald Advisors and Ceradex both outperformed nicely in a risk-off environment, as did Pierford in your international equity, based on country and security selection, lower volatility. You can see First Eagle on the next page in your global equity, that with an underweight to emerging markets relative to the benchmark. And then with a smaller allocation at $21 million, you can see that Intech low vol strategy really did a nice job of giving you low vol. And performed even better than expected in a strongly down market. And then moving down into fixed income, your total domestic fixed income, you can see your Goldman Sachs underperformed by 190 basis points there. They had an underweight to treasuries and an overweight to corporate, so again, credit issues there. Selection in mortgage-backed securities also to some degree. Lord Abbott, similar story. They had an overweight allocation to high yield and triple B credits, so the lower end of the quality spectrum. Moving down, all the way down, what you can see in your total high yield, sort of right on top of the benchmark there on page 12. And then global fixed, you can see Lazard underperformed by 110 basis points, still pretty strongly ranked relative to peers for the quarter, but relative to the benchmark, they had a shorter duration. They were underweight the U.S. and Japan, and again, an overweight currency and an overweight to credit. And then in your inflation hedge, so we talked a little bit about this, you can see that negative 5.7 versus the CPI plus 4, the very stable CPI plus 4 number there. And so PIMCO All Asset, they had some emerging market debt and equity in there and currency exposure. So you can imagine how that might have impacted a portfolio broadly allocated across multiple asset classes. And also the Wellington Real Total Return Fund. They use trend and valuation to also invest across asset classes. So it was those sort of betas in the portfolio, those risk exposures in the portfolio, not explicitly linked to inflation, that caused problems for both your managers in that space. Okay. And I have no additional comments and would be happy to respond to any questions that you all have. If not, that would conclude my performance report for the quarter.
Such a somber time.
I have a question, actually. Are we gonna talk about the closed-end funds?
Or? We certainly can. So the closed-end funds, we typically don't go over on a quarterly basis just because they are so long-term, unless there's any issues, but happy to respond to any questions or take them back if I don't have the answer off the top of my head.
Yeah, so just given that our next item on the agenda deals with Ocean Avenue. I just wanted to ask if you were going to do this already as a part of that item, so if you are, you can tell me wait. But in looking at page 18, what I see here is a $30 million commitment that's only been 35% called and a little bit distributed. Can you comment on, or I guess, are we going to go over that in more detail, where they are on that fund as a part of the...
I will defer to your...
Yeah, we will give you an update on the status there.
Okay.
Okay.
Ask a question on page 9. You have an analysis, a total fund analysis, gross of fees. Did you have a similar page for net of fees?
No, because the data that comes to us about peers is gross of fee data. So that's...
is there any estimate? I mean, is there? Could you do a plug figure? Is it 50 basis points? Maybe that's a better question for Tim. Somewhere around there.
So we do have a fee page, and I'm just...
Like that annualized return of
if you want the net of fee numbers without doing the universe comparisons, you can just turn to page 7. So you do all the performance, both gross and net of fees. As well as all the manager performance, gross and net of fees.
So a comparable number then is to the 9.51 is at 8.8 for a five-year number, right? Annualized total fund return?
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
Which is a decent number, at least for me, to keep in mind if somebody says, you know, over the past 5 years, et cetera.
Scott. Scott, page 11. J.P. Morgan Global Opportunities, total global equity. One of the things I always look at when I go through this is how a fund is ranked against everybody else. And JP, for the 3 month is at 77, the year to date is 82, 75 for the 1 year, 52, I don't mind 52,
yep.
69 is pushing my button, but it looks like it's going, to me it looks like it's going the wrong way. Is there a correction for them that you think will occur, or is it something that we should pay attention to?
So I don't think it's anything that you should pay attention to.
Okay.
This trend is a very short-term trend going from 3 to 1 years, yeah. Right? And if you look at the vast history of manager return performance, it's very cyclical, both relative to peers and relative to the benchmark. And it's interesting where if you just plot a manager's returns mm-hmm. against the benchmark or against peers, and then you take that same return, so the return stream may look like that, right? You take that same return stream and you move it back 3 years. So now at each point you're looking at a prospective 3-year return mm-hmm. and a historical 3-year return. They're almost mirror images of one another, which just really highlights the cyclicality of manager returns. And so I would say, I think if people wanted to implement a no-brain, just do this and don't even think anymore about it, they would actually sell managers when they're outperforming relative to peers and benchmark on a 3-year basis, and buy them when they're underperforming mm-hmm. relative mm-hmm. to peers and benchmark. So this type of trend from a 3-year to a 1-year to me is somewhat meaningless and even maybe encouraging.
Scott, you might just ask for your reaction on the net of fees, gross of fees, 1 year, staying away from less than a year.
Yeah.
We go from 2.6 to 2.1. It's like about 50 basis points.
Yep.
Then we jump out to 3 years and it's 70 basis points and it sort of stays in the 70-60 range. Is there anything else that we ought to know about those differences?
So you mean in terms of the fact that it's seems to have come down over the longer term?
Well, it's gone up, actually.
Well, so let's see, then I'm misreading it. So 1 year.
1 year is 50.
5 years, 70 basis points, right?
Right. Right. Mm-hmm.
So over the longer term, it's higher than it is more recently.
Right. I'm just asking for your reaction.
I think that's good. And I don't, frankly, I don't know. I don't know why that is. I don't know if your staff can shed any light on why fees may have come down a little
bit.
Yeah,
I mean, part of this is cyclicality of when fees are recognized.
Okay. There's a timing issue. We record it when...
if somebody invoices in June 1 year and July the next year, it's going to skew the numbers ever so slightly. So the one-year number can be off a bit. The long-term numbers are all going to be accurate. We're running at about 60 basis points all in.
Okay. Good. I thought from at least my point of view and board in general, having an overall sense of that number is something we have to be aware of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would say over the past decade, as we have moved a bit more into private equity and private real estate, I think we've seen those long-term numbers kind of migrate up, but not a whole lot. And we'll talk to you something of going from a number probably 7 or 8 years ago, more like 56 basis points to today, probably at 63, 64, but it's, plus or minus 60 bips.
And if you use 60 times 7 billion, you're talking 42 million.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
I think the number on our last CAFR was 41 million.
Okay.
And I think it's also interesting to at least have awareness of the fact that the fee calculation, when you look at the number here, you go from 9.5 to 8.8 gets you 70 basis points roughly, right? That fee calculation is an estimate still because you have many fees that are reflected in the net asset value, the NAV, or the share price of the funds that you're invested in that don't show up in that 70 basis points.
All the transaction fees, for example, would typically.
Yeah.
The net number is a solid number. The gross number might actually be somewhat higher.
Right. That's right.
Every embedded fee.
Okay.
If you were to look back again on 7, it's just a snapshot, but you could easily draw the conclusion that the fixed income, global fixed income, and to a lesser extent, shorter time period, obviously, for total inflation hedge, but if you just focused on the global fixed income, that's an anchor. If we're talking about, back to this anchor analogy again, it's not helping contribute to our reaching our bogey. It's a drag.
Not only
over 5 years.
It doesn't seem as though they're meeting the benchmarks, and so then that would, again, sort of make the case for why are we paying fees in that space.
Right.
Or higher fees for active management.
Then that's not a 5-year picture, not even a 10-year picture that you could be particularly pleased with.
Yeah.
Just perhaps keep that in the back of your mind. We're going to be talking about new asset mixes.
Yeah.
8 days from today.
Okay.
So I was going to make the point that all observations and conclusions are up for grabs on December 2nd.
Okay. Harvey?
Question for the board while we're on fees on page 18. If I understand this correctly, Signature got the very bottom of the list. So in a year and a quarter, out of a $200 million commitment, they've actually only called about $37 million.
Which page are you on?
18.
Page 18, the last item on Singular Cut. So we committed $200 million. They totally called in a year and a quarter about $37 million.
I'm seeing
but
nine.
We're paying management fees on the
remaining commitment.
Million quarter by quarter.
So is that one where the fees are paid on commitment? Or
that was a negotiated separate account. So that one... we are not paying fees on full freight there. We negotiated a 5-year relationship, and we reflect, and I would have to go back to my notes to see exactly what the fee structure was, but we moved that in the direction of invested capital.
Excellent.
Okay. Yeah.
Good.
Anything where we have stretched out the relationship to reflect along the fact that we're a long-term strategic investor, we've moved away from paying on full committed capital and towards the best of capital. Sometimes perfectly, sometimes steps in the right direction.
Abby, where did you find the 37 million?
I'm not seeing the 37.
Well, the remaining commitment.
It's the remaining commitment and subtracted it from the 200.
Or you can multiply the total commitment percent of all times the total commitment and get you about the same number.
Since we're on this page, and this is probably more for Tim than you, Bay Area Equity Fund, the 61404 fund, when are we going to be done with it? The 1103 fund on EIF Power Fund 1, when are we going to be done with it? And then Pathway, 11.9 of 98, and we still have 54, estimated market value, 54 million?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take those individually. Pathway was our original fund of one where we committed in subsequent tranches. So we started in 98, but we actually committed in four tranches. So the last commitment in there was, Chi-Chi, help me out here, 2004, 2005?
Yeah.
And it's a fund of funds, so that will run ballpark 12 years from that point, 12 to 15 years.
From four, it'll go 12 more years?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're almost there.
On this the is Bay Area Equity Fund, up. They just came back with a request to extend it by 2 years to do the last exits, no management fee for the extension period.
Okay. I'll die then.
EIF.
What investment only?
Yeah, it's we're tailing it now. It's just clean up right there.
All right.
It is, you know, we share your frustration that some of these, they have a stated 7 or 8 year life with extensions.
And we're going 10?
They end up being 15 year vehicles. We share your frustration. We are working on better
all
models.
Right.
That conversation will be continued probably in March when we take a look at how we engage on private equity in the future.
Okay.
I was going to say, well, we're broadly on this topic. Those who were Zachers saw the presentation on the, is it Coons report, I think?
Yeah.
Anyway, Contra Costa came out in spectacular form.
For you and your crew. Yeah. Number one, numero uno.
It's a nice place to be.
Yeah.
Nowhere to go but down.
Yeah.
Nowhere to go but down.
You guys start talking about that stuff, I just cringe, but so be it.
No pressure.
Yeah, right.
Mr. Chairman, unless there are any more questions, that concludes my report.
Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you very much. And I wish you all a wonderful holiday season.
You too.
Bye.
Okay, presentation from staff.